Welcome to the State of Games. I'm Dice Hamey.
I'm Get Louder.
And I'm JJS1.
And this is episode 97, or as we like to call it, the one about location, location, location.
Like, where is TC's location?
Exactly. Right. Recently, we were planning on having Puppy Shogun with us, but we just checked. We've tried calling him about six times. We've also told him we were going to record at a certain time. He is not here.
He's in the middle of his seventh deep conditioning phase of his hair.
You're right. Yeah. He's working on his hair. Or more than likely, he is actually sleeping, which mm-hmm. is what we assume. He is a vampire, even more than me. And actually, I've tried to get back to a normal schedule so I can actually enjoy my holiday road, which I'm currently on. Speaking of location, 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 this week I'm going to be all over the place in the North Carolina mountains and eventually ending up at Daryl's house, probably about a week in Dover. Right. We're going to be working on some game designs. We're going to be also, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, evaluating the Dexterity game design submissions for the Dice Hate Me Greater Than Games Dexterity Design Competition. Hopefully, if TC wakes from his slumber and wants to join us a little bit later, that would be great. We'll just get him in the middle of the conversation and add him in. But otherwise, it's going to be us three talking about this week's meat of the podcast, which is basically about, the subset of a game theme, which is basically where the game is located. So, you know, places like Middle Earth, space, some obscure town in Belgium in 1793, the typical Euro type of thing, and whether we think it makes a difference in immersion and how the game sells. You guys ready to talk about that?
I am. I got a nice little list here of places and
get out
games that I think the location matters, and games where I think the location is just an afterthought.
You made notes?
I made notes.
Oh my God,
I'm
people.
Not home, but I came prepared.
It was hard for me to, because I haven't played as many games as you guys, so.
That's okay, because you can give a fresh perspective on that. Yeah. Which is good, because we're going to mention some games you might not be 100% familiar with, but you can also talk about, like, what would describe the location you think. Well, does that interest you? And what's also interesting, and this is a little pregame or, pre-podcast talking, is that Jessica doesn't like history.
Sorry.
So this is going to be really good. Although she is geeky and nerdy, so she does like space and Star Trek and stuff like that.
Space.
Yeah, so we'll have that perspective, which is good, and all, as usual, having that new gamer perspective and finding out, well, if we have a game set in, let's say, Bruges, whether you might be interested in that game, regardless of theme and so on and so forth. But we'll get to that in a little bit. That's the meat of the podcast. For right now, we're going to ask, first of all, I want to ask everybody, did they have a good Thanksgiving?
I did. Thank you for asking.
You cooked a lot, dude.
I did. I ended up smoking three birds.
Putting it into a smoker, not actually smoking it.
right. But I spatchcocked all three of them, and I did a Periscope video on the first one I did to show everyone how to spatchcock. And
by the way,
fun. I got a lot of really positive feedback on that. By the way, it's just random.
Spatchcocking.
Yeah. Spatchcocking is where you. It's the best way to actually cook a whole bird. And so what you do is, while it's raw, you flip it upside down so the breast is down as opposed to up like you're used to, uh-huh. and you cut the backbone out. So you cut on both sides of the backbone to completely remove it. Then you flip it back over and kind of do a really brutal CPR press right down in the center of the breast and snap the keel bone, and the bird will lay flat. And that way, when you put it in the smoker or even in the oven, it's all getting the same amount of heat. There's no, like, the breast is done before the legs and all that stuff. None of that happens. So it all gets done at the same time. The skin on the entire bird is crispy. It's not like, oh, this part's soggy. Like, it's just, it's awesome. And it's actually the easiest to cut up when you're done. So if you know how to properly cut a bird, cutting out all the ball joints, it's very easy to get to all those without, manipulating a lot of and ruining a lot of meat.
You may not realize this, but that's where the term flap it up, flip it up, smack it, rub it down. That's where that comes from.
Okay. Learn something new every day.
No, I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. But
I was thinking, it fits.
Yeah. Anyway, I watched Daryl's, he Periscoped it, and Periscope is alive. For those of you who are not technologically familiar with a Periscope, it's when you live, basically video cast something and people log in and check it out. I watched him spatchcock that bird, and I love bird. I love meat. I love everything about that. But watching him do that was like, whoa. And then at one point it looked like a face hugger. And
what?
Somebody said it like, it's a face
hugger. It was me. It was me. I commented. I said, oh my God, it's a face hugger. And I was like, if that thing got after me in a spaceship or a cave, I'd be like, Thanksgiving's ruined. No, but it is. I've seen you know, birds spatchcock before. I didn't really know the process of it, but it was fascinating watching it. At the same time, it was also like a little bit brutal because like Daryl's talking, he's got his gloves. He went through like 18 pairs of gloves while he's doing this thing, and then he's also like, okay, well, you have to roll it over, and then you have to apply a little bit of pressure, and then you hear just like crack, crunch, crack, crunch, and I'm like, oh man. And I'm not really, you know, I'm not a squeamish person, but watching him do it was enough. Okay, so anyway, so everybody had a good Thanksgiving. Jessica, what'd you do for Thanksgiving?
Oh, man. One thing about the holidays is everybody gets so stressed out. And my goal this Thanksgiving was to have no stress. And I was like, I'm not cooking anything.
You cooked a bajillion things.
Nothing. No, I didn't.
What? That spread you had.
What are you talking about?
Well, it wasn't for Thanksgiving in particular, but you had like a games day where you cooked.
Oh, that was Halloween.
Oh, that was Halloween. Oh, yeah. Is that long ago? Yeah. Sorry.
No, so for Thanksgiving, one of my gamer friends, she's single and has a roommate, but her roommate was going to go see her family. And she was like, I want to cook. And so me and the boyfriend went over there, and I did cook one dish. I cooked some bacon ranch green beans, but she cooked turkey and everything else. And I was practically in my pajamas. We were just like chilling, eating, and then we played some games. So it was nice and relaxed. I loved it.
That sounds perfect. Yeah. I went to my mom's as usual, and of course she fixed enough for like 18 families, and we ate way too much. But it's the typical Southern Thanksgiving meal. Had a great time. Watched a lot of football. My Bears beat the Packers, so I was thrilled.
Oh, they can win.
Shut your face.
I watched 0 seconds of football. Just the way I like it.
Yeah, I was about to say, that doesn't surprise me. But it was a good day because we beat the Packers at Lambeau Field on Favre Love Night, and that was amazing.
Nice.
So not that I have any disrespect for Brett Favre. I think he's a great player, and I, as a Bears fan, obviously I have a lot of respect for the Packers because I love our rivalry, but it was amazing to have that kind of a win on that night on Thanksgiving. So anyway.
Wait, I thought the Packers didn't like Favre anymore when he left.
Well, they booed him when he left, but of course, because he had contributed so much when he came back, you know, all is forgiven after a while. Time heals all wounds. Well, I mean, he's a great player. He added so much to football. I mean, even as a Bears fan, you know, you just want to, like, that kind of competitor you just admire. And he was great to see him back, but at the same time, it was also great to crush their spirits on Fourth Love Night. Yeah.
No, I understand that. I just, you know, I thought there was still animosity of him leaving. I mean, as in baseball, you don't boo the bad players.
Well, no.
So.
Exactly. All right, so let's move on. We're actually going to do a really quick rapid fire. And so since there's three of us, we might be able to get through this in actually 4 minutes each.
No.
We'll see. I'm going to set my alarm now. We have four topics for rapid fire. And you all have been prepped a little bit for these, so hopefully we'll have some good discussion on this. So 4 minutes. I'm going to hit start whenever I talk about the subject, and if anybody has any questions to clarify the subject, then we'll go. So number one for rapid fire, if everybody's ready, is why aren't there more holiday-themed games? So go. Daryl.
They're hard sell. Their limited audience, and arguably there'd be limited retail time to sell them. So a game store owner isn't going to put like a Christmas game out in the start of spring for people to pick up and purchase. That's why, like, winter Carcassonne, you're probably not going to see during the spring and the summer, even though it's not really holiday themed. I know of one holiday themed game right now, and it's being made, but it's, you know, it's not going to make it out for this Christmas, but it's probably going to be out for next one.
I know what game you're talking about, and originally it was promised for this Christmas, but we all, when it was announced, said that that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, because we know that it's a solid game. We know the designer. We won't mention it right now because we don't want to like bring it up. But yeah. So, Jessica, why do you think there aren't more holiday-themed games?
Well, I was thinking the same thing. You could only sell them at certain times of the year to get ready for when the holiday comes up. Some people don't celebrate certain holidays, so like you said, it'd be limited interest in particular games.
Yeah,
I wouldn't want to play an Easter game now.
Well, that's very true. It is seasonally oriented, and even, you know, Daryl, you kind of timed on it as well, like the winter theme stuff. Like, sometimes people may want to play a winter theme game. Like, for instance, I guess like the Nordic countries for Ticket to Ride comes to mind.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, I mean, it's winter themed, so you might play it around the holidays to remind you of, you know, kind of the wintry type of atmosphere and Christmas and so on and so forth. But, you know, those types of games that are specifically timed to either the holiday theme or a season are, I guess you're right, they're situationally oriented, and you want to make sure that you're appealing to the most amount of consumers when you design or at least put out those games.
Yeah. So I think, and actually, yeah. I just thought of one that it's the one that breaks the mold of that, and that's Dead of Winter.
Yeah, and I would agree with that.
And Hobo Santa's in that, so
that's right.
Well, Dead of Winter also is zombie oriented, so it can be played. I mean, it can be played anytime, obviously, but people are going to break it out around, like, I saw some people breaking it out around, you know, Halloween because it's zombie themed. It might be in the winter because it's got snow, winter themes. But yes, you're right. It does break them all. And there are some games out there that do. But I think you've hit the nail on the head in that holiday themed games are tough. We haven't seen a ton of Christmas themed games. I've seen a couple of Christmas themed games. I've seen a couple of actually Hanukkah themed games, which are interesting. But for the most part, even the ones that are like kind of like the horror theme, they don't focus generally on like Halloween. You don't see a ton of like, you know, well, at least America, like 4th of July, you don't see any other types of games that are specifically tuned to holidays, even though Christmas is something that some people look at year round to make a sale. So it's tough to sell those things outside of the realm. But within that, though, like, for instance, like holiday, just to bring it up, we got a minute left to go, but let's talk about Christmas Vacation. I'm just going to mention that flat out. Like, Christmas Vacation is one of those, and Christmas Story. So Christmas Story and Christmas Vacation are one of the top selling, well, beyond that. And the kind of the holiday and Christmas themed movies, but those modern type of movies sell a ton during the holidays. So you would think that maybe a game manufacturer or publisher may want to put out a game that kind of fills that niche to make a lot of money during that time. Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's really kind of weird that we haven't seen something that kind of rears its head every time Christmas comes around that's going to sell a ton.
Yeah, you're right. I actually think a Christmas Vacation game would probably be popular, because I feel like Christmas Vacation is one of those movies that is like geeky, nerdy people actually love too. And so I think it would be popular.
I think so too. And it's interesting, and it will be interesting to see if outside of, say, Europe, that maybe there's a North American centric type of game that comes out that celebrates Christmas. Because I think that, and we're, 1 second over, but I'm just going to mention this really quickly. The Brettspiel Advent Calendar, which was introduced this year at Spiel, is an advent calendar that introduces 24 expansions for games, and mostly Euro games. I guess all Euro games, because they're all based out of Germany. But they're the ones you can open up at, like, as an advent calendar and add to your games, and it's all Christmas-oriented, which is cool. So that's kind of something interesting and a little bit different. Although, you know, Germany and Europe have a slightly different, like, you know, focus on the holidays, a little bit different than North American audiences. But this is something we can talk about possibly later, maybe on the next podcast, as a matter of fact, because the next podcast will probably be very holiday oriented because it's going to be closer to Christmas.
Yeah, and Germany doesn't have a war on Christmas going on. It's just
it
here.
It does. Right, exactly.
Yeah. Just here.
Exactly. All right, so let's move on. Number two, my question reads, gamers claim that they want to see more games with unique themes or just a unique take on things, and yet a game like Tavarua, which I'll include a link to that on the podcast link on DiceHateMe.com with this, it's on Kickstarter, or just finished on Kickstarter. It just barely made funding. But it's all about surfing. It has gorgeous art, has pretty neat gameplay from what I can tell, and people who have tested it have said it's neat. But it struggled to make funding, and they actually only funded, they needed like 70-some backers to fund within the last 24 hours. They just barely made it, which was awesome because I love to see that. Mm-hmm. My question, though, is there a disparity between what a lot of gamers say they'd like to see versus what they'll actually spend money on, like a comfortable theme or gameplay?
I think this is a little unfair for this game, and I don't mean it negative to the designers or the publishers, but I think comparing numbers for a game that has this unique look and unique theme and putting it up in the holiday shopping season, that's painful. That is a pure uphill battle, and it's going to suck the entire way. There's always exceptions to that rule, but I think that's the issue.
You think something like Tavarua would have done better if it was released during the summer,
or maybe even January, February. Like once you get out of the holiday season, like I pull back from backing on Kickstarter during this time, and if something comes up, I'm like, and if I see it struggling, then I'll back. But otherwise, I mean, it's a hard, like this month, December is just a tough month. Maybe that's me, but I don't know. I think the demand for unique themes and stuff is there. People are tired of, as Vassal says, trading in the Mediterranean and zombies. And
yeah, but they're not tired of zombies because look at the selling trends.
If you have miniatures, then I'm not tired.
Right,
of
that's what I'm talking about though. Like people, the gamers, they in the backlogs of things, they say, oh, you know what? I'm tired of seeing the next zombie game, or I'm tired of seeing the next, X, a 4X game, or this, that, or the other, or something with miniatures. But yeah, you know what? That doesn't show on Kickstarter, and yet something that comes along like Tavarua, that is unique. I mean, there are tons of different examples of games that seem unique on Kickstarter that struggle to make their funding, even though gamers themselves, when they see it and they talk about it, and they're like, oh, hey, look at this cool game. At the same time, it doesn't always translate to the selling of that game.
Do you think it could be a thing where it's like, if you surf, you're probably going to be interested and want to back that game, and if you don't, you might want to play it before backing it?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Jessica.
Well, that was my thing is, even after years of trying to fight this fact, I realized I'm an indoor person and not an outdoor person, and I've never been interested in surfing. And I actually saw this game on Kickstarter, even though I had a moratorium on buying games. I found myself on Kickstarter looking at games, and before I'd heard anybody talk about this, I came across Tavarua, and it really is pretty. It looks interesting and fun, but surfing just doesn't interest me at all. And maybe though, if I'd seen it maybe during the spring or like early spring or late winter, then maybe, you know, thinking about, oh my gosh, I can't wait for it to get warm and be outside or whatever, then maybe. But for me, it's just personally, surfing just wasn't interesting to me.
All right, so yeah. Perhaps in this instance, bringing up Tavarua, like you said, Daryl, and I agree with what you said, Jessica, maybe it's a little bit unfair. But I just wanted to kind of like prompt the discussion because Tavarua is kind of one of those titles that is indicative of a trend where there's so much discussion of like, where are the unique themes? Where do we come in with stuff? What are we trying to do? I mean, like we try to do with Dice Hate Me Games and some greater than games products, you know, where that people haven't seen this particular theme or they might appeal to a certain thing and people want to explore those other avenues.
Yep.
And so Tavarua was just, yeah, I don't know. It's just indicative of the atmosphere that's going on right now, especially with Kickstarter anyway. So I wanted to beg the issue.
Well, we'll take a look at it's definitely going to be the topic of the theme. Like, take a look at Bottom of the Ninth. The people that know baseball, love baseball, are all, you know, hey, bottom of the ninth, cool. Or baseball highlights 25, cool. Other people are like, I don't know anything baseball, or I hate baseball, so I'm going to avoid this game like the plague. It's the same thing with Compounded, too. And I don't mean this just to mention my games, but it's, they both have very unique themes, and I see both sides of the thing. Like, oh, it's science, I had to have it right away. Or, oh, God, it looks so boring, it's chemistry. And yeah. So true. I see both sides of it.
Yeah, and this is absolutely every single one of the things that we mentioned up with Rapid Fire could be like a whole topic of a podcast. So these things may come up, and obviously they're going to come up naturally in our conversation. So we're out of time for this one, but I agree with what you guys have said. I think that, Daryl, you're spot on in saying that, you know, bottom of the ninth is probably indicative of it as well. But what the benefit of baseball is that a lot of people love baseball, so we did really well. They also saw that it was a cool gameplay. They saw the art and the components that were going to go with that game, so that made a lot of difference. Tavarua, unfortunately, well, fortunately, they funded, and we're going to see Tavarua in the marketplace, which is awesome, and that's what Kickstarter is about. So thankfully they made it, but, you know, it's just one of those things where you just kind of beg the question of, if you want something unique, then show and vote with your dollars.
Yeah.
Okay. So number three. This one's a little bit loose. And Jessica, you may not have had as much experience with this, but hopefully with your gaming group, maybe you've seen this. But number three is, have you ever rage quit a game? And part of that subset B, have you ever been playing a game where someone rage quit? Go.
No comment.
Yeah, right. Yeah. All right, Daryl, I'm going to table your comment for a second, but I'm going to talk to Jessica for a second. So, Jessica, tell me, in your limited gaming experience, you've only been gaming for a few months, but
yeah.
Have you ever, I don't think you've ever rage quit a game, but have you ever felt the need or the urge to rage quit a game?
No. Okay. My gamer friends do say that I have a death stare, though. Like,
oh, well, yeah, I can accost to that. Yeah,
I don't know what they're talking about, but
I believe it.
What? Okay, so for those of you who don't know, Daryl and I have actually never met. Nope. So he can't say stuff like that.
But I feel it sometimes while talking to you.
What?
Sometimes on Twitter, I'm like, oh my God, I feel it. It's like ice down my spine.
Whatever. My Twitter is sweet and friendly. But so a couple of times I've, like, you know, if I get hormonal or something, maybe I'll be like, I'll get really irritable during a game or something. But there was one time we were playing, I think it was it Halloween? I don't know. We were playing
Betrayal at House on the Hill.
Yes, Betrayal at House on the Hill. Yeah. And it was late, and a couple of people had never played it before. And so we were playing, and one of the women in our group, she just got really, really frustrated because she just didn't understand what was going on. And she was like, it was late and she was tired and hungry and stuff. And so at a point she was like, I'm just going to quit. I just can't play anymore. And so she did kind of semi quit. She ended up being the traitor.
The traitor, right.
And so we sent her out to go read her stuff, but then she came back. She was like, I can't do this. And so we ended up playing to find another traitor, and it ended up being me, and we played another scenario. But so, yeah, she got really frustrated and almost quit, but we brought her back into playing.
And that's a little bit of a different situation, too. Like, if somebody's not comfortable with a game, or it's a little bit different than the rage quit. It's just the frustration of saying, like, you know what? I got chose for something that I'm not prepared for, and that's a little bit of a different situation. And I can understand that. I mean, that happens to a lot of us where we say, like, you know, look, guys, I don't feel comfortable doing this, especially when it comes to a social game situation.
Yeah.
So let's turn it back on. We got a minute, 30 seconds. Daryl, let's turn it back on you.
Okay, I have rage quit one game,
mm-hmm.
and that was a demo at Origins this last year of Isle of Trains. And it was a mixture of being tired and not being able to fully comprehend what TC was saying when he was teaching, and also TC not telling me things.
And it's really too bad TC's not here right now. But anyway.
Yeah. And
this is the one you talked about before, right?
Yes. Yeah. That's why I'm not going to go into detail. Go find the podcast episode that I talked about it with that with TC, because we kind of bicker then too. But basically, I was trying to do stuff, and TC was like, no. I'm like, well, you didn't tell me that. And he's like, well, you should have known that because I taught you this. And I'm like, okay, I don't see how those go together, but whatever. And that kept happening. And then finally, I said, F it, and just stood up and walked away. Because there were actually people there that we were playing it with, and but they weren't buyers. There were people learning it's a demo, and I was like, I'm not going to ruin everyone's bad time because I'm having one. Right. But I mean, I have played Isle of Train since then, and I absolutely love Isle of Train. So it wasn't the game; it was all TC. and then, have I played a game where someone rage quit? Yes, but in my game group, the definition of rage quit is a little bit different. It's kind of, we just call it shutting down. And John Mueller, I'll call him out. John does this when he does not like a game. He will just shut down and just go through the actions and just be a complete poly pissy pants the entire time. And it just kills the game.
Yeah.
No matter what.
I've had that too.
Like, Stone Age is one of my favorite games of all time. And he just made it no fun.
I think we probably have all had someone who basically just doesn't rage quit, but just basically tunes out of the game. And that's different. That's a little bit different.
He did it with Mysterium.
Yeah, passive aggressive quit.
Yeah, like Mysterium. It's like he's one of the people guessing. He's not the ghost. And it comes around to him, and he just throws his marker on and goes, whatever, I don't care. And I'm just like, and the game is done, but we're still going to go through the actions and be miserable. Thanks, right. Jackass.
Right. And that's a little bit of a different situation as well. But and we've mentioned that in the past on some podcasts about, you know, is it okay to, like, say, am I done with this game, walk away from the game, whatever, but this is a rage quit situation. So we're out of time, but I want to mention mine really quickly. Have I ever rage quit a game? I have never rage quit a game, but I have definitely felt like rage quitting a game once.
Game was that, Chris?
Oh, that would be Zulkin.
What?
I know.
Oh, come on.
Shocking. Yes. I have never wanted to flip a table more than playing.
What?
Zulkin. I wanted to help you, but we were on the opposite side, so it wouldn't have done anything.
Well, yeah, exactly. We just landed right back where it was at. So, yeah, Zulkin, and everybody knows that story, at least anybody who's listening to the State of Games. If you haven't heard that story, hey, go listen through all the State of Games podcasts, and then you'll get that story. But anyway,
I want to say this right now, though, about that. Yeah. If TC listens to this, and this is going to be the test, bring Zulkin, because I will try it when you're down here this week. Or, you know, whatever. I'll give it one more shot. But that's going to be it.
Sure, I'll play it one more time, but I guarantee you it's going to be the same dang thing.
Well, three-player is far better than five-player.
Yeah, all right.
I don't understand why you guys don't like it.
Well, we'll table that. We'll talk about that later. I'll put that in the notes. All right, so have I ever been playing a game where someone rage quit? It wasn't a rage quit. It was a silent quit, and that was when I was watching the demo for Monster Truck Mayhem at Origins, and Philip DeBerry it was very silent, and he did it. It was very respectful. He put the dice down after about halfway through the race, and he said, no, I'm out. And I knew, because it just wasn't his game. Most people who play Monster Truck Mayhem are in it, and they love it, and they get involved with it, and they're just having a blast. But every now and then, like, maybe 1 in 20 people might feel uncomfortable about it. Philip did. And he put his dice down, and he very calmly, he said, I'm out. And he walked away from the table. And that was amazing. Like, it was amazing to watch, because I'm like, you know, that's the way to do it. Because he's just like, you guys race the rest of it. You know what? I'm done. And it was not his atmosphere. And I thought that was really, really kind of fun. But I've never really seen somebody where they, like, have literally gotten so... Well, that's not true. Oh, my God, we're running way long on this one.
It's but your fault.
There is a tale that was on another podcast about 2 years ago for the State of Games that is about Lifeboat. And anybody who knows Lifeboat, or at least me talking about Lifeboat, there was a coworker of mine that we were playing Lifeboat so intensely that she said, I hate all of you, and I never will play this game again. And she got up and walked away from the table. So that was a rage quit.
Yeah.
That was pretty bad. All right. So we're going to move on. Here we go. So we're moving on to question four. It's the last question. I want you to, starting with Jessica, we're going to go one game you played recently. Talk about the game, what you liked about it, and we'll move on to the next person. So Jessica, start now.
Okay. So yesterday I played Terra Mystica.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a big one.
Yeah, it is a big one. And I felt the same way I did with this game, just like I did with Zulkin when I was learning it. There's just so much to the game. So many different paths to take and moves to make. It was really heavy, and I was really... And it's kind of like... It reminds me of Catan, where it really matters where you place your initial dwellings at the beginning of the game can really affect what you can do the rest of the game.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And, yeah. And so, because I had no idea what was going on, and the rules are just so crazy, I just placed them places, and in the next time I play it, I'll probably think more about where I place my initial pieces. But I liked it a lot. Even though I lost, I was last place. But it's interesting. There's so many different things you can do. At the beginning of the game, two of the other players placed their dwellings right next to each other, so they were just fighting the whole rest of the game over which hexes to terraform and then build. And so it was really fun and interesting. I liked it a lot, and I can't wait to play it again. And Pandemic Legacy has not surpassed it for number two on Board Game Geek yet.
Number two? Wait, on Board Game Geek, is Terra Mystica number one?
It's number two.
It's number two.
So, oh, it's number
Pandemic
two.
Legacy is three.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I forget what was number... I forget what was number one.
Well, it should be Twilight Struggle. Twilight Struggle. Well,
no, it was Puerto Rico was up there for a while.
Well, and now Twilight Struggle. Twilight Struggle has stayed at number one for quite a while. So yeah, yeah. All right, so that's good. I mean, Terra Mystica is a great game. We played it first time with actually TC in St. Louis not too long ago. We talked about that on the previous podcast. So Daryl, let's roll into your one game you played recently.
This morning I played Cacao. And I played it with the Volcanoes expansion.
Oh.
It just came out.
Yeah.
And
you mean the one that you bought for me?
Yes. I bought Volcanoes for you.
That I don't have Cacao, but that's cool.
Which I didn't know.
That's cool.
So Cacao, we've talked about before. You're building a jungle. It's like Carcassonne, but far, 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 far better. The Volcanoes, they'll bring in this awesome element because... the four sides of the tile, two of the opposing sides will give whoever's there gold, and the other sides will take gold away from their village. So it's really cool when you get that. You can kind of play it and kind of screw your opponent just for that one drop, but it's still like a fun little like twist thing. And the other cool thing about Volcanoes is the punch board sheet that it comes in. It actually folds, so it goes into the box to prevent everything from spilling, so you don't have to hold on to all the cardboard sprues from the game, so now you can store it sideways without everything falling out.
Yeah, see, that's a really good example of how to do an expansion right, where if there's something wrong with your initial game, then just do something that does it. And I thought that was cool. When you gave me the expansion and you were talking about it and you were saying, like, this is what that does, because I know I've seen, you know, with your copy at Origins, mm-hmm. and talking about it since then with you, that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. But Cacao, we play... Leslie and I play it a lot. It was two-player, but that's pretty much a, hey, we've got 30 minutes. Let's play Cacao real quick. Sure. Boom. Drops on the table. So
it's a fun game. All right, so we're about 30 seconds to go. Obviously, I should expand this to 5 minutes each, but it doesn't matter. The recent game that I played, which you can hear more about if you listen to the latest Geek All-Stars, which dropped this week, is Champions of Midgard, which is a design... it's a game from Grey Fox Games, and you can hear more about it. I'm not going to go terribly into the gameplay itself, but it's about Vikings. It's a worker placement game. You're going out and fighting like trolls and these things in the sea, and you have to buy, and not necessarily buy ships, but rent ships and take them out to the sea to battle these monsters in the sea versus land and the troll. Anyway, it's a sort of a worker placement, but also a dice use game. So when you place the worker around getting different things, you can also draft these Vikings that are in your... entourage, or whatever, you know, we want to call it, your Viking troop, they can be used to fight either the troll or the ones on sea. If you go into the sea, you've got to manage these journey tiles that come out that could possibly take away some of the food that you're using to feed your Vikings while you're on the sea. So it might take away some of the dice you're using to battle. There are three different types of dice in the game. There are swordsmen, spearmen, and axemen. And the swordsmen and spearmen both have shields. The axemen don't, but the axemen are a little bit better at killing because they have die faces that have more hit values on them. And I really had a good time. I mean, this is one that kind of came out of left field for me. I didn't really know much about the development of it, but it got released, and a lot of people were buying it and playing it. I saw it at BGGCon. I saw it, in preview at Gen Con and other places, or also at the 24-hour marathon. And it looked cool. It's got great art. The board looks nice. Of course, it's worker placement, so I think that's going to be cool. And I played it, and it's one of those that I don't think is... Some people have been, you know, comparing it to Stone Age and Lords of Waterdeep. And in my opinion, it doesn't replace either of those games. Nothing probably can because they're both classic. But it does things that actually combine both of those together that is a new sort of gaming experience that's both comfortable, that if you want to try it and play it, I think you'll really like it.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's Daryl, you'd love it. I mean, you like worker placement.
Yeah.
And it's one that I considered buying for myself, but I haven't found it at a price that I mean, this is bad to say, but I haven't found it at a price that I just kind of want to buy to show it to you, because Dan has it, and when I play it, I'll, of course, play with Dan, so I don't necessarily need to have it in my library. But
I guess I have to come down to your place sometime, then.
Well, I guess so. Well, darn. Shucks. Darn. But I think you would like it. Jessica, I think you'd really like it as well. You haven't played Lords of Waterdeep yet.
No, I haven't.
But you know, you're familiar with worker placement. You're familiar with some of the gameplay mechanics that go behind it. I think you would really like it as well. It's a little bit more combat-oriented, but it's not overt.
I like combat. Yeah, I love Kemet.
Well, there you go. I mean, well, Kemet is far more combat-oriented than Champions of Midgard. So it's a fun game. I recommend it.
Well, question, because you said Viking, so I immediately thought of, was it Trigdrasil?
Yggdrasil?
Yep, that's the one. That Viking game. How's it compared to that? Because I've heard a lot of people recommend that one to me.
I have not played Yggdrasil, but Yggdrasil is a co-op game, from what I understand, right?
I don't know. Everyone's like, oh, you need to play that game. I'm like, okay.
I've heard a lot of good things about it. I've not played it. But, of course, it does have the Viking theme, and it has the whole Norse mythology with the Tree of Life, and Yggdrasil, of course, being representing that. But Champions of Midgard is much more like Viking life, like, you know, little things around town that you place your guy in and get resources, and then you get Viking dice, and you fight people. And so it's, I think it's going to be very different in gameplay. But as far as, like, if you like Norse mythology and like Viking sort of things, then mm-hmm. Champions of Midgard is going to be one you're going to gravitate toward a lot.
Cool.
I was listening to a podcast, and somebody on that podcast said that it actually does replace Lords of Waterdeep for them.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that from a lot of different people. And in my opinion, I've played Lords of Waterdeep a lot. And again, if you want to hear more of this discussion, listen to the Geek All-Stars. But in my opinion, it does not. It does not replace Lords of Waterdeep at all. Lords of Waterdeep has a very different feel. You're gathering adventurers to go and take on these, you know, these plights and adventures that come out. It has a, of course, with worker placement, it's going to be very similar, but in my opinion, they complement each other nicely. So it's not a replacement at all, in my opinion. But I'd like to hear more about, from everybody listening, if you feel like Champions of Midgard, if you played it, and you feel like it's a replacement for Lords of Waterdeep, or even, God forbid, Stone Age, which is one of the classics of worker placement games, let us know. Comment on the podcast, that's at dicehaming.com, or comment on our guild at 1903 at BGG, or tweet us and hashtag State of Games to join the conversation. So that ends the rapid fire for us right now. We're going to move on to the meat of the podcast. Is everybody ready?
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a second to talk about location, location, location. All right, we're back. So let's talk about the meat of the podcast, which is location, location, location. So basically what we're going to be talking about this podcast is what's in a location. So in some ways, the location of a game seems like a bit of an afterthought, but in many games, the location is one of the most important parts of a theme, which many of you who have gamed have no doubt seen. So basically this seems particularly true for Euro games, but we'll get to that. What I'd like to start out with a discussion is asking you all, how important do you think the location of a game is to the theme in particular?
I think it varies on the game.
Well, dude, don't even put that.
I agree with that. So.
It's very true.
It is true, but let's open it up a little bit more. How important do you personally, Daryl, think the location of a game is to the theme? Like, put your actual personal opinion into this for a second. Not your objective opinion. This is not journalism right now. We're talking about opinion. Let's go. Well, how do you think, like, when you're buying a game, when you're looking at a game, I know it depends on the game itself, blah, blah, blah. But if you're looking at a game, like, how important is the location of that particular theme of game important to you when you're thinking about buying or playing the game?
Not at all.
Well, interesting. Not at all. Okay, so you don't care about theme at, or location at all.
Oh, that's not my buying decision.
Okay.
It's usually the game and the theme and the gameplay. Where it takes place usually doesn't bother me. That's
at the bottom of your rung of considerations for buying a game.
Yes.
Okay, so how about enjoying the game?
It's higher up.
Okay.
It'd be up there closer to theme.
So that's interesting that the disparity between you buying a game and what you might enjoy about a game are different.
Yeah. But again, as I said, and you don't like it, it varies. And I have a list here in front of me of why that varies that I'm going to be arguing with you at a later point.
Okay, Jessica, I'll open the question to you then.
I think mine's reversed from Daryl's.
Okay.
For me, location is much more important, I think, when I'm thinking about buying a game. One example I can think of is... I was unable to go to the Gamers for Cures marathon, but because I had registered and paid and everything, I was still offered a grab bag, and my decision on which games I wanted was one of them was a space-themed game, and I love space. So that's the only reason I picked that one. I didn't know anything about the gameplay.
Right. Space junk, right?
Yeah, space junk. Mm-hmm. So, but then when I play a lot of new games. Obviously, I'm a brand new gamer, so I try to play as many new games as I can. And regardless of the theme, if the gameplay is good, the theme doesn't really affect how much I enjoy the game or the location.
Arguably, to you, all new games to you are new.
Well, yeah.
I said that backwards.
Okay, so you don't... So, Daryl, you place basically the enjoyment of the game dependent upon... partly dependent upon how well that location is represented and how well it immerses you in the game.
Yes.
Jessica, you are opposite on that. But
location does matter, but sometimes it doesn't. I mean, like it really does depend.
It depends. I know. This does not make good podcasting. If we just open it up, here's the question. Does location matter? Well, it depends. Okay, we're done. Let's go on to the end of the podcast.
Okay, yes. No, I'm sorry. I worded that poorly, but I'm kind of being true. Like I said, it doesn't really matter to me when I buy it, but when I play it, it does.
Okay, well, and that's good. I mean, I like the fact that you both have kind of a different opinion on that. In my opinion, it is a mixed bag, I will admit that. But for the most part, if I'm enjoying a game and that game is actually embodying that location that I'm in really well, I'm going to enjoy that game more. And that's just simply because I'm much more of a thematic gamer. There are going to be some that are just like all about the mechanics. They don't care about the theme and they're just like playing it for the mechanics itself. And I'm like, as long as this makes your, you know, it makes sense to me by my spreadsheet brain, then it doesn't really matter. But for me, I like games that tell stories, and I like games that when you're playing them, they can tell stories, and location's a big part of that. And that's kind of why I wanted to open up this discussion for the podcast. I know a lot of you out there listening are going to have some opinions on this, and that's good. But we're going to have, right now it seems like we're going to have a pretty good mix of things. So let's move on to the next thing. Jessica, you've already answered this a little bit, but is a game set in a specific location a draw for you?
Definitely.
Right. So I said as an example, like desert games or space games, you've already said that like things set in space will attract you.
Yes.
Okay, and why is that?
I'm a Trekkie. Like, I just love space. I love that there's, you know, new worlds to explore. And I love ships flying and stuff. So anything that embodies that. I love Battlestar Galactica is one of my favorite games. The Space Junk game, I haven't played it yet, but I read it. And even just, like, the description on the back of the box where it, like, does a comedic play on... The introduction to Star Trek is hilarious. Right. Like, so I just love, I don't know what it is about it. I just love it.
I think you'll really like Galaxy Trekker when you get a chance to play it.
Oh yeah. I need to try that.
Cause it takes place in space.
Well, not only does it take place in space, but, I mean, Vlada's games are really good about this as well. And I'd like to take a subset just to talk about that. Like, Vlada Chvátal is really good about embracing the theme, but also the humor of that theme. Galaxy Trucker is one of those games that you, basically what you're doing is, there is a two-part game. The first part of the game is you are having a timed race where you're revealing all these tiles in the middle of the game of the board, and you're trying to build your spaceship. And your spaceship has to think about different things, like, and there's different configurations for the spaceship. One is like, which part when I'm flying through space, and the second part, am I going to be protected with shields? You've got some lasers that may shoot at some things. You've got places for not only your cargo to be picked up if you have a mission to pick up cargo, but your crew. There's a lot of different things to think about. And then the second part of the game is the actual space theme of the game, where you're flying through space and you encounter these different scenario cards that might be like, okay, is there an asteroid belt you have to fly through? And you have to make sure that you either can blast them, or you have shields that protect you, or there's a planet. If you manage to race ahead because you put enough engines on your ship that you're ahead of the other players, you get to choose whether you want to go down to the planet's surface and sacrifice some of your movement to pick up some cargo so you can get points at the end. It's very thematic, but it also embraces the space theme really, really well. But Vlada also does something really well with his other games. Like, he does Dungeon Pets, which is all about, you know, a dungeon atmosphere. But one of the ones that's kind of an unsung hero is Travel Blogger, or Travel Blog, which is you representing a travel journalist who is going around and visiting parts of the world. I know you laugh at this, but this, yeah, I know you guys haven't heard about this, but no. I actually reviewed this on Dice Hate Me like forever ago, like maybe 3+ years ago, because I saw it in the game store, and because I like Vlada's designs, I just picked it up and I'm like, oh, I'll try it out. And a little bit of knowledge about geography does help, but you're basically traveling around the world trying to spend the least amount of euros and getting the best experience for your travels, for your travel blog. And it's totally immersive because it's based in the real world. You have different maps. You have both Europe and US and different things that go on. And it's a really fun game. And there are some games that are so immersive in location, especially when that one considered. Like, CGE does a good job of, or Czech Games, what is the E? I'm sorry, I don't know what the E. I think experience, but
entertainment.
Yes, Czech Games Entertainment. Possibly, I have to look it up. I'm sorry, I apologize for listeners right now, but you know, I just know them as Czech Games. They do a great job of immersing you in the theme and the location that they have available for that game, and that's really fun to me. So
it's Darryl,
edition. Thank you. Oh my gosh, I can't believe that I blanked on that. Anyway, so Darryl, for you, are there certain like locations that are a draw for you?
Historic, and I don't mean like historic like medieval. I mean historic as in, I'm failing here. I guess it jumps around. Like, I'm not a big fantasy. Like, I like Lord of the Rings. Sure, I'll play Middle Earth games, no problem. But I'm not like knights and all that stuff. More of older like early 1900s, 1800s even, it'll bounce around from place to place. But I kind of like the more historic kind of looking games, and especially if they can integrate that history into the actual game, as opposed to just like, hey, we just happen to be in like an old jungle. That's it.
Right,
That's why I'm like, when it buys, typically it doesn't matter. When playing, it does.
But the enjoyment does. So there are, I mean, you might say that there's not... This is the thing that comes back to it, too. You might say that the location doesn't really apply to you when you buy, but it might still play into it. And
yeah.
I mean, like, for history, like, what specifically, can you think of an example for a historic game that you like that makes a difference both thematically and you recommend it to others to buy?
Okay, I swear to God I'm not pandering, but New Bedford, right off the top of my head.
All right, we're gonna revisit New Bedford later in this video of the podcast, but yes.
Okay. That, I mean, that's, it's got the historic element. The location does matter within the game because it's true about that. And it's just, it's everything. It's there. There's that one right off the top of my head.
It is one of those games. And again, we're not pandering, but again, we are, because we love this game, obviously, because we wanted to produce it. But I mean, Darryl was the one who introduced me to New Bedford. And now we're going to be putting it out from Dice Hate Me Games, State of Game, or Greater Than Games. And it's just, it's a perfect marriage of all the different things. Immersion and theme and location and gameplay. So it makes a big difference. Is there another one you can think of off the top of your head?
With the historic element?
Yeah.
Cacao, played it today, but it's the whole historic village in a jungle. And I know I just mocked that, but I mean, I kind of can't see that played anywhere else. I mean, yes, it could be played in space, so I guess now I'm correcting myself. Eldritch Horror. It's got that older feel, like same as Arkham, same as Elder Sign. Right. It's not this modern take, it's an older take on it. It's got kind of rustic vintage feel to it. I love stuff about that. I love it.
Well, and that has a certain subset too, because like Eldritch and Arkham and even Elder Sign, like they're immersed mm-hmm. into the realm of the 1920s and 30s, you know, H.P. Lovecraft era and Cthulhu mythos era. So they're fictitious eras, but at the same time they're based upon real, you know, time and space locations. Or not.
Right, but I mean, like, they could easily make that modern time, I mean, and still have the Cthulhu story. There's nothing in any of Lovecraft's stuff that's like, this has to be the 1920s.
You know, right, and there are some role-playing elements that bring it into the modern times, and you're right. It's just, it's fun to play that game knowing that there's this unknown element of the 20s and 30s that you're playing it in that is very immersive.
Yeah, but that ties into me with theme and art. Like, it's just, I like everything about that, so.
Yeah, I would agree with that as well. I mean, for myself, like, I put it as an example, like desert games or space games. Like, I don't have a particular draw to the desert. Matter of fact, I like games that are based at sea. Like, I'm very, matter of fact, I mentioned about, you know, Essen, one of the big things that I'm into is, like, submarine battles and World War II. I mean, part of one of my majors or minors, mm-hmm. sorry, in college was military history, especially naval history. And so I'm very much drawn to those types of games. And so I wanted to make sure that I got the Come Unseen. I have Steam Torpedo. And those types of games, again, we'll laugh about the name of Steam Torpedo.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. It's horrible. But anyway, those types of games really appeal to me because they appeal, you know, they're pertinent to my interests, so to speak. So yeah. I think location, as far as that's concerned, like if you're really into something, whether it's history or space or naval battle, that's going to draw you into the game, especially if the gameplay itself brings itself is evident in the gameplay.
Yeah.
So as a subset of that question, I have another part of that question is like, are there certain parts of the world? So this becomes more evident, and again, we'll put New Bedford aside because we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But are there certain parts of a game like Asia world like Asia or Europe that you are a little bit more drawn to in a game for location?
I wanted to say no, but then you said Asia, and I immediately thought of Tokaido. But again, that's art. It's weird. It's the art that's indicative of the location is what draws me.
But that's okay, because that's hand in hand. But exactly, that's hand in hand. That's part of the game itself, because that's immersed. It's yeah. it's bringing you into the gameplay itself, which has a certain subset of the location. And that's what we're kind of talking about right now. So Tokaido is a good example of that. The art itself makes you feel like it's very an Asian type of feel for the game, even the gameplay itself and how it works along the path and so on and so forth.
Yep.
Jessica, for you, is there a part of the world, maybe like Asia or Europe or some set that you might be more drawn to?
I think I probably would be. I haven't played too many Asian games, but because I'm half Korean, it's just like I just automatically kind of go there. Like I have one Samurai Spirit, you know, it's Japanese. I have a thing for cherry blossoms too, so if there's any cherry blossoms in art, I'll be drawn to it. But I definitely would anything.
Have you played Tokaido?
Like
yet?
That's why I picked the Dungeon Busters, because it was the Korean game. So.
Well, there you go. Yeah, and there you go. I mean, that's a perfect example of when we were asking you about what games you're interested in. You know, Dungeon Busters, the theme itself is not Korean, obviously, right. But the design is Korean, and that played a subset. And what you were considering. So, mm-hmm. All right. So that's important as well. So when people out there are both buying the game and also designing the game, which is going to roll into our next question, you have to think about the location that you're setting the game in. Not every single game is going to always, you know, lend itself to a specific location, but you should be thinking about that when you're designing something. So, Daryl, to you as a designer, this was open to Daryl and TC in my original questions, but TC will chide him again, is not on the podcast. So, Daryl, take the reins. When you're designing a game, do you think about a specific location?
No.
You're more, this is unfair too, because it's a little bit, you're more of like a time period or a specific subset of like where this is going to take place.
Well, yeah, but there's one game I'm working on now that is a location, and the location does play heavily into it. You're sailing the seas, so the island placement and stuff, but it's not like we're taking a place. It's just a very fictitious ocean, very fictitious island placement. So no, not really. Typically, yeah, I design the game. I know what the theme's going to be, and then I'm like, "Well, what time period do I want to place everything in?" And that's how I go. So yeah, location with me is kind of tricky. I'd say TC's probably the exact same thing because he doesn't really have any location games yet.
Yet. Well,
if he wakes up, he might have one.
Yeah, possibly. He kind of does because I mean, Club Zen takes place.
Oh, damn it. You already proved me wrong. Yeah.
Right. True. In a location, which is, and Club's End is all about, you know, going to a retreat where you're trying to relax away from your work, but at the same time, you've got to balance your work life with your personal life, reduce your stress. And so the location of that game makes a big difference as to how the actual theme plays through.
Yeah.
But it's not a specific location. It's not like, again, we bring up, because we're familiar with it with the Dice Hateman Games universe, you know, New Bedford lends itself to that because it has to be in a certain location to make sense for the theme of the game.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll move on beyond that. A lot of you out there, I'm sure, are designing games, and we have a lot of game designers who listen to the podcast. So if you're designing a game with a specific location in mind and it makes a huge difference, again, comment to us, Guild, Twitter, everything, let us know. But we're going to move on right now to personal games that you have all played. What games have you played, and we've mentioned a couple of these, where the location is most evident while playing? So in other words, what games do you think have done a good job of making the location a star of the game?
I'll start.
Go ahead.
I'm going to surprise Chris with this one. Omega Virus.
Oh,
you're welcome.
Oh, thank you. That's good. Okay.
Yeah, that one was like, you know, I'm not huge into space games. I'll play them, but they're very low on my, oh, it's a space game, I gotta buy it. But when you pull out Omega Virus, you totally feel like you're on the space station. The fact that the game talks to you helps with that immensely. But it's like there's no focus. Like that's the main focus, and very much the location is the star of that game because of how you have to move around. So, Omega Virus for me.
Yeah, Omega Virus is a good example. I'll just chime in real quick before Jessica, just because it ties into the same type of game, because it's the same time period. But Fireball Island, it does the same thing. Like, it's just an island in the middle of nowhere, but it's like that prototypical, like, volcanic island with tiki gods and stuff like that, and the whole volcano in the middle, and there's a tiki god that drops volcanoes down these chutes and knocks people over. It's like, that game itself immerses you in the fact that you're on this island and you're trying to survive and make it to the end so you can get the treasure and then get off the island as quickly as possible via the boat. But at the same time, like, these fireballs are shooting all through the island and you're trying to take you out. I think that's really a fun and immersive gaming experience that would not be the same if it was somewhere else.
I need to play that.
Well, maybe I'll pack it in the car.
Oh, no, it's way too big. I'll play it another time.
It's way too big? Dude, I'm driving a car.
Yeah, it's a mini. Fireball Island box. Half the size of your car.
I'm going to put Fireball Island in the car. So, anyway. All right, so Jessica, how about you?
I don't know. I had a hard time kind of answering this question because I'll play some games that don't necessarily in a specific location or anything, but maybe Tales of the Arabian Nights. My friends and I have been playing that a lot.
No, we said a game.
It's a storytelling game.
It's a storytelling experience. It's not a game.
There you go.
But
well, then, how about Merchants and Marauders?
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, you're out to sea. You decide if you're a merchant or a pirate, and you're sailing, getting goods to trade and earn gold. And if you're a pirate, you're battling to steal booty from other ships. I mean, it's pretty fun, especially when you're battling. The battles can actually go on for a while, competing to see who will win the battle to win the booty. So, yeah.
Okay. Nice. That's fair. I think that's a really good example. And in mine, I had some lists. Hawaii. It's a Euro game, of course, but it's, of course, set on the island of Hawaii. And as you're playing it, you feel, and not necessarily immersive with, like, totally with Hawaiian culture, but at the same time, you have, you know, actions that you take where you're gathering certain resources or trying to build up your huts or your tribes or things like that. I think Hawaii is a good example. Euros tend to do this, and this is a subset we're going to talk about in a little bit, but Euros tend to do this a little bit more than American type games do. But at the same time, another one on my list that's the quote unquote Ameritrash type of game that does it really well, which is Axis and Allies. You cannot play Axis and Allies because without thinking about the location or the various locations, because it takes place around the entire world. And this is historically based, so you're fighting the European front, or you're trying to defend America, or you're trying to, you know, take over the Pacific. This is a very location immersive game that, as you're playing, plays out throughout the historical events of the game itself. But it's one of those that, like, if somebody was, it's a time period more specific than it is location. But at the same time, when you're playing the game, you feel like you can feel those different limitations of the locations being played into the game, like how many people you can have on a specific island in the Pacific, or how much you can march into Russia with the amount of troops there, or the amount of resources you get from that particular area. It's very geographically oriented, so you can't separate the two in that game, or you can't separate the temporal aspects of that game versus the geographical aspects of that game, because they're all tied together very, very closely. And it's one of the best examples, at least from what I think on my list, of location makes a huge difference. And there are also subsets of Axis and Allies. There are some that focus on the Pacific War or the Pacific Theater. There are some that focus on mostly the Eastern European Front. Those types of things are huge as far as like the geography of what you're playing in and how you have to realize that geography makes a difference in the game. Two other on my list, really quickly I'll list, is Downfall of Pompeii. And again, it's not, you could have like the geography anywhere, but the fact that it happens historically in Pompeii, where there's an eruption, you're trying to build up, you know, your followers and things are going on in Pompeii. And then after the volcano erupts, you're trying to escape the city before the lava flow takes it over. And so historically, but also geographically, it makes a big difference in playing that game.
Yeah, but you don't historically throw the people in the volcano.
Yeah, but that's only representative of they got taken by the lava flow. That's just mostly. Yeah, I know, it's a great game, and it's only the thrill of like, ooh, I got your guys, I'm gonna throw them into the volcano. You know, it's just like one of those things. And finally on my list is Letters from Whitechapel. And I feel like the location of this game is really super important, because obviously it's Whitechapel in London. It's representing, a specific time period, which is during the Jack the Ripper. And the geography of the game board itself makes a huge difference in the immersion of the gameplay. So that game itself becomes like, okay, there's a location, and there's a time, and they're tied together. And it's really fun.
I didn't know we were going to... I can blast my list off here real quick.
Please, go ahead.
So as I said earlier, Omega Virus. As I talked about already, and I'll just touch on New Bedford, Cacao, and Tokaido, all for reasons we already talked about. Macau. It's one of the Euros, I think, where the theme actually plays a role into it. So it's all about the city being initially built, and it's... resource management and sending stuff out. So it's shipping and trading in the Mediterranean. But I liked it. It's very good. It's a very fun game. And then two that I'm surprised neither of you touched on. The first one is relatively new. It's not out yet. But Chronicles, the fact that how that is being played out. So we only played chapter one at BGGCon where it was, building a tribe. But right. That whole, the card engine, the effects that happened and everything very much felt like, okay, yeah, no, this is definitely the Stone Age. This is definitely everything that's going on.
But I think, like, just touching that for a second, the location of that game, I mean, it's more a time period thing, and this is actually, we're getting more into the temporal aspects of things than we are the location, but part of the Chronicles part of that is that one of the tracks that you can advance and explore is, like, the land outside of your specific tribe space. Which is cool.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other one, Chris, I'm surprised you haven't touched on this one, is Time Stories, because
we're doing time. We're so doing time travel right now. But yeah, you're right. You're right. Go ahead. Go ahead.
But yes, you have your initial setting where you're in modern time. But when you go back in time, that location takes over everything. I mean, it's very much exploring that location, and you want to find places in that location, and you get lost in the location, figuratively and literally. And I probably think that's one of the most recent games that is the location really matters.
I will agree with that. And I think that's a great example because, we're getting caught a little bit into the temporal aspects of the games. But Time Stories is more, it's a MacGuffin for investigating certain time periods, but that also involves the locations. And we've only played the first scenario, but playing Asylum, without any spoilers, but playing Asylum, you're inside this location and it becomes your world.
Yep.
And you have a certain, and this is not giving anything away at all, it's mechanics of the game. You have a certain subset of the cards that come out that form the location you can explore. And you can actually uncover new places that are part of that location throughout the gameplay. So you're exploring within this very limited space that becomes more open as you explore, which Time Stories is not the... the end all be all that. There are a lot of different scenario based games, the D&D games like Wrath of Shardalon and Castles of Ravenloft and things like that. But Time Stories is one of those that puts you into a certain time period and location that immerses you in that location so that you really understand that, okay, this is our limited view. Do we investigate X part of this location or do we investigate Y part of this location? And it's a lot of fun because you're not really thinking time-oriented now. You're thinking you also have to, part of the mechanics is you have to investigate or think about the time element of how much it's going to take you to investigate this place. But you want to make sure to go to a place you think makes the most sense for your party. And that's kind of fun. That's not kind of fun. It's really fun.
Yeah.
And that also helps you to immerse into that environment of the game itself because the time period and the location makes a huge difference. All right. Jessica, do you have anything else you want to add to this before we move on?
Nope.
Okay. So my next question is Euros versus American games. So which of those value location more? This is a hard question because obviously Euros have had a lot of history of doing this because let's just throw something out. Like I already threw out Axis and Allies. Obviously that has location orientation, but it's worldwide. But then you got something like, say, Bruges or Macau or any other failed game that throws itself into a specific location. Like Euro games are very much like, oh, we have these mechanics and we have these things we want to do, like Troyes. Well, let's just set it in a historical location and go.
Yeah.
So which do you feel like that Euros versus American games, at least what you played, value location more?
I can't answer this question because I think since I've gotten to gaming now, the blend between what's Euro and American, I can't really distinguish what's a Euro game really.
I think the line's getting blurrier.
Yeah, and well, so for me, I have a hard time.
I agree as well, but I wanted to offer that question, because it's been a traditional question that we all bring up, especially in the tradition of the historical context of gaming. But you're right, modern gaming has gotten a little bit more blurred to that. And like we've mentioned before, New Bedford does that.
Yep.
Which is one of the things that Dice Hate Me Games, and at least the aesthetic that I wanted to set forth, was blurring that, is that the Euro games are taking place in a certain time period and location. Same thing with Dice Hate Me Games. We want to make sure that you're being immersed in that environment that you're playing in. But I guess traditionally, do you think that Euro games set forth that it had to be in a certain location versus American games, or what do you think?
It definitely feels like Euro games are forcing the location more upon you than American games.
Okay.
You brought up a great point with Feld, and I even went further thinking St. Petersburg, and you know, and so on and so forth. I think the Euros value location far more, and the American is more just, you know, if they're more focused on the mechanic.
Okay. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that Euro games, in my opinion, force the location of the game more, but I actually feel like American games immersed you more in that location than some Euro games did.
Yeah.
Simply because American games focus a little bit more on the immersion of theme, versus the Euro games were a little bit more immersed in mechanics. And again, the line has been blurred in that a lot, which is good, because I feel like you need to have both to make sure that gamers are getting truly into this. But, you know, like, again, it goes back to the whole hybrid New Bedford thing. It's like, can you create a game that has Euro mechanics that immerses you in the location, that it absolutely matters where that location is?
Yeah, and well, like, some of the Euro, I don't even know if this game considers itself a Euro, but one where the location's forced upon you is Carcassonne, but that location means nothing while playing that game.
Well, it kind of does.
No, it really does not. That could be any place. It does not mean it's Carcassonne.
it's true, but actually, when you build the game and you know the historical context and location of Carcassonne, France, you understand how that game's tied with location.
Okay, if they can easily retheme it to Star Wars, then the location's not really all that married to the game.
All right, fair enough.
I thought Carcassonne was a made-up word. I didn't even know
really?
The name of a... Yeah.
All right.
A location.
See? Case in point.
All right, well, that's fair enough. So part of what I was talking about when I said we mentioned New Bedford as a hybrid, and again, we're not tooting our horn here, but we're most familiar with this game. New Bedford itself could not exist without New Bedford, the location.
Right.
Like, it has a lot of, I mean, it's mostly Euro mechanics, but the entire theme of the game was built around Nat wanting to emulate that particular time period and location in history with the gameplay, and it does. And so one of the things I think is the benefit of modern gaming that we have is that you can build a game. Yeah, if you have a great mechanic in mind, sure, go for it. But if you can try to time it to a certain period, but also geographically located in a period that makes sense, and not only that, but immerses the person and thinks they're in that time period, that's going to be a huge boon, especially for modern gamers.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, so let's move on to the next one. What are some of your favorite locations in your favorite games? Jessica, let's start with you.
Well... I can't wait to meet Daryl, because apparently we're really opposite, but I love the medieval period. So even though I don't like history, but I love knights and damsels and all that kind of stuff. But so anything in Camelot, I would love.
Okay, so Shadows Over Camelot, big
one
for you.
Yeah, I actually do like that game. Anything in space, a spaceship having to do with space. That's all I can really think of. Other than theme, those locations I really do love.
And let's caveat that by saying that you don't like history. other than kind of the medieval type of thing, but whatever. You don't like specific history, so you're not going to be embroiled in, let's say, Panamax.
I don't know what the game entails, okay, what it's about.
All right, so Panamax is all about the Panama Canal. And it's modern Panama Canal. It's not historical. I mean, it kind of is, but at the same time, Panamax...
There's an iPad in the game. It's modern.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's pretty modern, but it's all about, you know, trying to push your ships and goods through the Panama Canal, whether it's yourself or other players helping to push your ships through to make sure that you get and make deliveries. But the location of that game is paramount to the game playing.
Mm-hmm.
You could not play that game without the theme and location being intertwined.
Right. But I would play it.
Well, I'm sure you should,
because it's great.
Yeah. Well, it's our, you know, it's the game of the year for, you know, 2014.
I know, I heard you talk about it. But like me, mostly it's like, I guess maybe I don't care as much. I'm not as much of a history I'm not a history buff like some people are, especially like you. But, and especially if anything has to do with like war and like World War I, World War II, blah, blah, blah. I just can't do it.
Okay. That's fine. Daryl?
Yeah.
You've mentioned some of them, but what are your favorite locations and your favorite games?
That's the thing. I listed a bunch, but one that I didn't even think about until Jess just said something, and that's actually Resistance Avalon.
Oh.
And I stress the Avalon part because it's King Arthur's court, and that actually, I like how that is incorporated more than regular Resistance, even playing the same roles. But I don't know, it's just having those pictures and that art style and everything with that game, with that medieval, you know, fantastical time period. I really, really enjoy it.
Well, what's interesting in us talking right now is that I probably should have thought about how our locations actually tie into temporal events.
Evidently, I'm wrong on everything then.
No, you're good. No, you're good. This actually opens it up in a conversation because this is something that is, we talk about emergent gameplay. We're talking about emergent podcasting right now. So a lot of what we're talking about with theme also seems to be tied into time, at least historically, when we're talking about in the past. Now, Jessica has brought up the fact that she likes space, and that's in the future, and that's fine. But if we're talking about like medieval times or... You know, like if I talk about Euros and or New Bedford or something like that, that they're a specific location in a specific time. And that's a little subset that I didn't think about to try to include with this conversation. So if you're thinking about a time period, then the location where that time period is makes a difference too, because history and the historical context of that is going to make a huge difference. Like, Jessica, you said you don't really like, you know, play into the whole, you know, war game type of thing.
Right.
Right. Well, I like war games because I like military history. So if I think about, well, if I'm going to play Axis and Allies, or I'm going to go back and look at like 1812 or something like that, it's going to make a huge difference to me where it's set, because of course that's a historical context. And so we're going to talk about playing out a scenario versus the geography of that situation. That has to be super immersive in the gameplay, or else that game has failed.
I just realized I lied.
What's that?
I played the Grizzled.
Oh, the Grizzled. Oh, good one.
And I liked it.
Right. Well, and that's more... The Grizzled is more of like a temporal... theme that it is a geographical
war.
Theme, but it is war.
Yeah,
it's, you know, it's World War One, and that takes into account that. Well, that's fine. In my list, I think one of my top 10 games of all time, which I've mentioned before, is Shogun, and it's based on the Wallenstein engine. But to me, I've not played Wallenstein, and I would, because I think I'd love to play it with a different, map and geography, which is with Germany. But
own it. Why don't we play it?
I know we should. We totally should. But Shogun is based upon feudal Japan, and the geography of the game itself and the map itself makes a huge difference on how you're managing like your people and trying to block off certain advancements on the map itself. And the geography of Japan is great too for the immersion of that game. But you could not play Shogun. I mean, you could make, I mean, like we said, you could do anything. I mean, you could make like this, you know, planetary system in space and do Shogun in space. You could. But yeah. The fact that it's set in a certain time period and you're playing in a geography and the location is Japan, it's cool to me because I'm fascinated by that. And I love the historical context of that. So Shogun becomes one of those games that builds everything around itself to make sure that the game is totally as immersive as possible and it succeeds. So that's a big one to me. Letters from Whitechapel is another one that I mentioned before, but again, playing in Whitechapel, you could not, I mean, you could, if you want to, in a space station in the far-flung future, you could have Letters from Whitechapel. There's a guy running around killing people, and you've got to find them. Spectre Ops does the same thing. It's hidden movement. You could just kind of, you know, play around, and there's Spectre Ops, and you're trying to find, you know, the hidden person or the hidden group. But Letters from Whitechapel does such a great job of encapsulating a certain time period, but also a certain geographical location, that to not make sure the game is adherent to all those values is going to be a disservice to the players, and it's not going to be as immersive as it possibly could be.
That is one that, I mean, I know we're not talking about what we need to play, but one I want to play as well as Mr. Jack, because I have Mr. Jack Pocket on mine, and that is, it's, I know it's more of an abstract game, but I don't know, the location of how the buildings are and stuff. I know they don't really twist and turn like a Rubik's Cube, but yes.
It does, though. I mean, Mr. Jack Pocket is an abstraction of what Mr. Jack is, and Mr. Jack, in general, does have a specific geographical location and time period, and the way the city is laid out, or the town is laid out, makes a big difference on the gameplay itself. It's not as immersive as something like, let's say, Letters from Whitechapel, but it does make a difference. Cool. But it's tied, and again, this is emergent podcasting, but it's tied into a specific time period. So that may be something that we have to look at when we're talking about, you know, geographical areas or location. It has to be tied into a time as well.
Well, isn't that what a location is, a place and time?
Well, location is just a location.
But, which is a place and time.
But now, yeah, but now, through the wonders of podcasting, we have pretty much come down to the fact that it has to be a location and time.
Maybe I just shouldn't watch Doctor Who before recording these.
Well, yeah, maybe so. All right, so let's move on to the next part of this. Unique locations that you've seen in a game.
Meaning like fit, like I've actually seen this place.
No. Games you've played where you're like thinking, oh, that's new. Like unique locations or unique groups of locations that you haven't really seen in a game before.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood that because of the second item on your list. I was like, oh, okay, cool.
Oh, you mean despite the list that I put with the notes on the podcast?
Well, you put trekking the national parks. I thought you were saying, like, I actually went and trekked, like, backpacked to the national parks.
No, that's a game.
Okay. I didn't know that. Wow. All right. Unique location.
Well,
Tokaido. Going to say Tokaido. Because it's not like done like the feudal samurai, your feudal Japan or anything like that. It's a different spin on the Asian locations, and I thoroughly enjoy it. It's different.
Okay, Jessica.
I hope it's okay that I talk about it, but Matt Wolf's prototype, the game Ubar.
Oh no, that's good. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's set in the town of, it's a card game, but it's set in the town of Ubar, which is called the Atlantic of the Seas Atlantic of the Sands, because it ended up just sinking under the sand. The foundation got all of the town got destroyed, but you're trading frankincense. And I can't remember everything about the game. I'm horrible explaining how games play, but I had never heard of Ubar, and and the gameplay was interesting. I really liked it. I've actually been obsessed with it and really want a copy, and somebody needs to publish that game.
If we only knew a publisher.
I know, right?
I don't.
Somebody make some calls.
I don't publish desert games.
Tell them to put a camel in it.
That's right.
This will be all over it.
That's right. If there's a camel in it, I'll do it.
There's no such thing as a bad camel game. go ahead. Because you said prototype. Yeah. Then I'm going to say Galapagos Expedition, and that's a prototype by Chris Bryan. You listeners may know him from The Board of Life, but he did a tile placement that's like discovering animals in the Galapagos Islands by exploring the islands by placing tiles and like colored patterns. So it's kind of like building a reverse puzzle. That location is clearly very unique because how many Galapagos games are out there? So yeah, Galapagos Expeditions.
All right. Fair enough. Well, you already spoiled one of mine, but Trek in the National Parks is one of the unique locations that I've seen because nobody's ever done a national parks game that I know of. I think that's a kind of a fascinating theme. It was on Kickstarter not too long ago, recently released. And it's all about, obviously, trekking the national parks. We've mentioned the Kickstarter for King of All Mountains. And yep. This is all about, like, you know, mountainous terrain, but you're trying to bring people in to visit your mountains and make sure your mountains are the best visited and most prestigious mountains ever, which is a really weird theme, but we all just loved it because we gravitated towards it because it's unique. And there's been, you know, as far as, like, unique locations when it comes to games, a lot of the locations have been done. But I mean, I guess you could throw in a lot of Euro games as far as unique locations. I mean, nobody's really done Double Up on Bruges or Troyes or something like that. You know, any kind of small historic town in Europe, possibly.
Seven Wonders, it covers all of them.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, Seven Wonders covers all the Seven Wonders of the ancient world, rather.
Well, what about locations that it's a common location for games, but it adds a unique spin or insight on that location?
Like what, Daryl?
Well, like what if there's like a farming game and you immediately think, oh, it's a farming game, but it's a farming game from the viewpoint of the animals that are on the farm.
Like,
I can't think of a game that does that, but I'm just...
Oh, you mean like Don't Get Eaten?
No, I might make this now. No, like TC did, yes, exactly, with Don't Get Eaten. Like, farming is very done, but this isn't farming. This is like from the animal's point of view on the farm, trying to more or less escape the farm or escape certain death. So it's just a unique twist on the farming thing.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there's plenty of seed out there for doing something which is a twist on something you've seen before.
Yeah.
And that brings us into the next topic that I'd like to bring up is what locations have you or do you think in gaming as far as theme-wise have been overdone?
Space, medieval times. Jessica, what else did you like?
Whatever.
No lie. And I'm not trying to make this all about me and games I haven't played, but... when I was initially shopping Compounded, not even shopping Compounded around, I had it sent out for a blind playtest. They came back saying the chemistry theme is boring. You should change it to a castle building his court or a king building his court. So building a castle. And then like, that was the first thing that came back. So of course, Chris was interested at the time. So I said, Chris, this is what they did. Chris went, no. Immediately.
Yeah, I'm like, no, I would not publish again.
And then that's the thing. It's like medieval stuff is kind of white noise now. Like, same with space, unless it has a unique twist or a unique insight on the theme, or it's got an IP like Firefly, it's not going to jump out at some people.
And that's not to say, like, I mean, what are the benefits of kind of scouting games for the Fable Nexus brand or the imprint that we do for Greater Than Games is that, you know, I can explore the space theme, which I love as well. I mean, I won't lie, I love space. I'm kind of picky on my fantasy themes, but space, I'm like, oh, a space theme, yeah, let's play that. But it is overdone. It's just trying to find a space theme that does it in a way that's immersive. And like, you know, I've got a couple of space theme games. Project Alcazar's space theme right now. I like to do for Fable Nexus. And, you know, it's just like, we want to make sure that this game is telling a story, that it's not just rehashed. We want to make sure that it's immersive for people. And, but yeah, space and fantasy, in my opinion, are both way overdone. We're getting to the point where there's saturation on the post-apocalyptic theme. Well, not necessarily post-apocalyptic as far as like Mad Max wise, even though there should be more of those because they're awesome. Yeah. But like the whole zombie theme thing, which is the post-apocalyptic, this, again, this is more temporal, but location wise, like you're trapped in the desert of, you know, the Western United States or whatever, that is, those types of things like could be possibly overdone if it's related to the theme of zombies, but there could be twists on those things.
Someone needs to make a game in space about zombies and trading on the planet Mediterranean.
Oh my God.
That would be amazing.
That would be interesting, yes.
Just the most common stuff all in one game.
So Jessica, do you think that there, and you're, I mean, I know you've only been gaming for a little bit, but do you feel like that exploring the realm of gaming, is there a particular location that may be overdone?
I really don't know if I can answer that. I hear people constantly talking about how there's too many farming games and, you know, the trading in the Mediterranean. What are some trading in the Mediterranean games?
Well, there's not really. I mean, that's a Dice Tower joke, but it's far as like, you know, okay, we're going to have like trading around somewhere around Greece or, you know, any of the Mediterranean locations, or
if you're trading and in a boat. Trading the
moment. Right, exactly. Yeah.
So I don't know if I can answer that really. I think that I kind of feel like regardless of the location, if the game's cool, even if you do this, you know, have another space game or another, you know, desert game or another whatever game, if there's like a new mechanic or, you know, different kind of, you know, facet to the game, then it'll be fun regardless.
Such a new gamer answer.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. No, it's fine. No, that's good though. I mean, you haven't quite reached the level of, you know, I don't know. What's the right term, Daryl? What are we, like, jaded gamers?
Elitist.
Elitist gamers. All right, so let's move on to something a little bit more hopeful. What place might you most like to see in a game? Like something that may not have been done before, or may have been done not enough or right. What sort of location would you like to see in a game?
Again, I'm going to name something that goes against everything else I've been saying already, but I've always wondered why no one has made an Apollo 13 game.
Oh yeah.
Like a co-op where you're out and you've got to try to get back.
Okay.
Like why not?
Again, that's a specific time period, but okay.
Well, the location is you're stuck in your space capsule.
Okay.
In space.
In space.
Yes.
All right, Jessica, what about you?
What place would I most like to see in a game?
Yeah.
Come back to me.
Okay.
I tried to think about this. I couldn't think of anything, but there's something on the tip of my tongue, I think.
Well, I'm going to bring one that's a little bit near and dear to my heart, but it's Ireland. We haven't seen a ton of Ireland-based games. We've had some that have failed to fund or been published. Ireland is interesting for me because Isle of Trains was Ireland-based. Dan Keltner and Seth Jaffe, especially Dan, was making the actually Isle of Trains be Ireland. And when we first introduced that game, we wanted to make it set in Ireland, or at least an homage to Ireland. I will say that. And when we put out the game proper, we flipped the map and we put some Irish locations in their general locations. And a lot of Irish gamers said we don't like that because it was not exactly geographically specific.
I was about to say, you can't use that map to backpack through Ireland.
Right, exactly. So that was a little, I mean, I'll be honest with you, like from a publisher standpoint, to represent Ireland or at least have people think about Ireland and the representation of Ireland, it was a little disheartening because, yes, it didn't look exactly like Ireland, but we were like, we want to make this Isle of Trains and we want to use these Irish names and make sure people are thinking about Ireland when they play the game. But when we posted it on BGG, a lot of people said, like, well, the Ireland's upside down. And I'm like, well, what do you mean upside down? Like, is there any general location as to how geographically on the earth is upside versus right side? And they're like, well, north is south and south is north. And I'm like, okay, well, that's only based upon your typical orientation of a map. And they were like, well, you know, Cork is not exactly in the right location, or this might be, but everything was kind of generally in the same location. And in the end, there were so many people who were commenting and saying, like, well, yeah, if you want to do Ireland, just do it, like, absolutely realistically. And so finally I said, fine, we'll just make it a fictitious island and not have any reference to Ireland at all, which in my opinion kind of disheartened me, because, you know, I love Ireland and have an Irish heritage, and I'd love to do it, but there were so many comments against it. I said, you know what, we'll just do it as a generic island. So I'd love to see more Irish games. I'd love to see more, like, if there's some Euros specifically based in Ireland or a specific location in Ireland, I'd love to see those. And anybody out there who may be developing an Irish game or a location in Ireland that's specific, please make it very, very specific to that location in Ireland, and don't kind of generalize the location, so to speak.
And if you're looking for a publisher, pitch it to Chris with a bottle of whiskey. Irish.
It would take at least one or two bottles of Irish whiskey to make me want to publish that game after the feedback we got from Isle of Trains. So, yeah. Yeah. And which, again, it's one of those things that I'm saddened by, but at the same time, I understand people's, you know, perspectives and what they want to have to make sure that it's truly representative of things. But at the same time, yeah, Ireland for me. Jessica, we're back to you. Anything?
Yes, actually.
Oh, yes.
What about, like, the ocean floor or okay. under the sea, the ocean floor? I love marine life. And I feel like somebody could really go crazy in terms of kinds of sea creatures that have not been, you know, discovered, and all kinds of, I don't know, something that, and, like, you know, traveling through the Earth's crust and stuff. Like, I love that kind of stuff too.
So, like, a more of a, like, a Jules Verne Journey to the Center of the Earth type thing.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. Well, also, you have not played Aquasphere, right?
No.
Okay, so Aquasphere is interesting too, because, and I love that kind of theme as well, location. What drew me to Aquasphere initially was the fact that it was based on the ocean floor. It's a research undersea research, you know, compound, and you're doing these different experiments, but at the same time you're trying to fight off these squiddies that kind of get inside the compound itself, and it's really fun. Also, we're talking about, like, undersea things, and I love, you know, submarines, but we got. What is it called? Red November. Red November is one that's from years past that I really like. It's a co-op game, but it's all basically around this submarine that's run by gnomes, and you get possibly at one point attacked by a kraken. You're trying to make sure that the submarine doesn't sink. There's these fires that happen around, so it's a semi-co-op game. I say semi-co-op because one gnome could possibly get to through the airlock and escape the submarine if it's about to explode and win the game completely and just leave the rest of the gnomes behind. But I really, really like Red November. I love underwater themes. I love nautical themes. But yeah, I'm totally with you on that. Aquasphere, you need to play, though.
Yeah, and, like, I was thinking, like, Abyss, the movie The Abyss.
Well, The Abyss is in my top five movies of all time.
Yeah.
So you're preaching the choir there, but... There's the game called The Abyss, which is all about underwater stuff as well, and creatures that dwell there. I'm not a big fan of that game. Some people really love it, and it got a great reception when it came out.
I was thinking more of the movie.
The movie. Oh, I would so love to do a game based around the movie The Abyss. That would be amazing. So I'm right there with you. If anybody out there is developing an Abyss game, you can contact me at chris@diceab.com.
And include a bottle of whiskey.
Absolutely. So, do you guys have anything else to add to this particular topic before we move on? I think we've covered a lot of ground on this. We've established through emergent podcasting that a lot of location depends upon the time period that it's set in, which is good. We've come to that point. Anything to add to anything we've brought before? Everybody good?
Yeah. I'm good.
Have you done a topic on time periods and stuff?
I mean, you know, kind of like peripherally, whenever we talk about a theme on the podcast, we always generally gravitate towards some sort of time period. The only thing that doesn't lend itself to that is when we do the future, because it doesn't really matter about that time period. But that generally comes into play about, you know, like, you know, the space. Antarctica is really the only game I can think of in recent time that has done a futuristic setting other than post-apocalyptic that is set in a specific geographic location. And Antarctica is cool because it uses Antarctica as that location. But it's in the future. It's talking about, like, you know, research vessels going in and building these other resource development compounds and things around all of Antarctica itself. So I haven't seen a ton of things that do that, but it would be interesting to talk about, or at least table for a future podcast where we talk about our favorite time periods.
I think so too.
Yeah, that would be awesome. All for that.
All right, so everybody out there listening right now, you've listened to the podcast, you listened to our discussion. If you'd like to join this discussion, you can always comment on Guild 1903 on BGG, comment at hashtag State of Games on Twitter. We will be watching and listening. And, of course, comment on this podcast at DiceHateMe.com.
Yeah.
All right. So.
Oh, you know what?
Yeah.
Daryl didn't do his little musical interlude.
Well, luckily I saved all the stingers, so I'm going to play the original stinger instead of Daryl's musical interlude. So now that we're through with the meat of the podcast, let's move on to the last part of the podcast. So, Kickstarter. It's been kind of quiet. Yeah, exactly. There we go. We got a lot of. It's quiet because it's December. First thing I'd like to mention in the Kickstarter segment is our failed funding for Monster Truck Mayhem, which was sad.
It's very sad.
It is very sad.
That's a word for it.
Yeah. It's unfortunate because it was our second attempt at Monster Truck Mayhem on Kickstarter. We had so many people who played the game, so many people who were excited about the initial launch of the game. And a lot of those people who were excited when we launched it in the summer came back and funded. Unfortunately, there weren't a ton of other people who jumped onto that bandwagon. And we don't know necessarily that that was because of the time of year or whether it's because of the theme or, again, because of the price, even though we lowered the price by literally $10 off the initial offering. So Monster Truck Mayhem for right now is tabled. We regret to say that it will not happen. It's like a lot of people who backed Kickstarter say, like, well, I can't do this right now, but maybe when it's in retail, I can get it on discount, so on and so forth. But Monster Truck Mayhem is one of those games, and we always say this, we're not going to publish it if it doesn't have the Kickstarter backing that we need and it doesn't have the reaction that we need on Kickstarter. So Monster Truck Mayhem is one of those that will not be in retail. At least not for the foreseeable future. We're going to say no and not never. You would see it on Kickstarter if we're going to try to do it again. But for right now, we're going to move on to other projects that we know we've been working on for a lot. We'd like to try to see the response on Kickstarter from all of you out there listening. For right now, for those of you who did support Monster Truck Mayhem and spread the good word, we appreciate it. We thank you so much. But for right now, it's a dead project. So, yeah. We hate to say it. Moving on. We'll have more about Monster Truck Mayhem in the future. Hopefully, we'll talk some more about things. We've got some other projects in the works from Matt Riddle and Ben Pinchback, who are the designers for that, including Project Alcazar, which is a really cool small box Euro. Later in the year, I'm working with Matt and Ben on Legends of Sleepy Hollow, which you guys have heard me mention on the last podcast, which is an amazing, immersive, totally like theme-driven sort of Ameritrashy, but it's got Euro components in it. It's going to be super cool. And we hope to have more details on that as we develop that. And Hopefully, we'll be able to launch that late in 2016. So stay tuned for more on that.
And I'm working on going to sign Ben's consolation game. So
what's that?
He's making a game about those constellations, like the actual constellations.
Oh, the constellations,
the
not constellation. I thought you said consolation.
Same here.
No, sorry, the constellation game. So yeah.
So if you haven't heard, or well, listened to two, I think it was two podcasts ago. But anyway, it's the one about Marlins, Monsters, I can't remember. I think it was episode 95. Yeah, exactly. I think it was episode 95. A couple of episodes ago, we had Matt and Ben on, and Ben talked about constellations and a game he would like to start building for that. It's really cool. Something is an idea that I think he should definitely pursue. So, you know what? Pay attention to that for Daryl's new imprint.
Yeah.
I don't know when that's coming. But
it's called Better Than You Games.
Better Than You Games. It's called Consolation Games.
Hey, I have a question.
Sure.
It's a random question, kind of off topic. But do you guys ever worry when you talk about games you're developing or anything that somebody might steal your idea and try to produce something else?
Game about pirate accountants. Not worried about it.
That's something we've actually talked about in regards to the I'm trying to think, I guess the etiquette as far as like what you should do when you're developing a game. We've mentioned that we don't really believe in non-disclosure agreements as far as like designs are concerned with Dice Hit Me Games and Greater Than Games, because one of the things that happens is the more you talk about your game and the more you get it in front of somebody, the less likely somebody's going to be to steal it. Because if they do, then a lot of people are going to chime in and say like, well, this person's working on this and they've been working on it since X years. And they're going to be like, oh, really? And that's going to affect them in a certain aspect. But nothing prevents somebody from just like going ahead and like taking somebody's idea and doing it. It probably in the long run will hurt them, but also the time that somebody's worked on something makes a big difference as well. For instance, working on a project or a game that involves a lot of like play testing to make sure the game is really good, somebody could rush something out ahead of someone else. But if somebody's been working on a game and really putting in front of people and doing play testing for like 2 years, if they rush it ahead, like doing it in 3 months worth of like putting together a game just simply because they think it's a good idea, it's probably going to show in the long run.
Yeah.
So we don't worry about that too much. And I think that's one of the benefits is that not only does it help us to talk about a game in advance of it coming out, and also in its development phase, it boosts buzz, but it also helps us to make sure that people who may, and there's not a lot of this in the board game space, anybody who's a hanger-on or may want to steal that kind of idea, it's not really going to be wise for them to do that.
Okay. And also, some publishers will even notice if a designer is kind of rushing things, like, oh, here's this, or turns over a project that's kind of half complete and expects the publisher to do it. And publishers are starting to become more aware of that and kind of peek up, like, wait, why? And we'll do research and see what's going on, and if they find something similar out, they'll say no before the yes is given. Okay. So, yeah, the tides are turning in the game industry. It's kind of weird right now, but fun, like weird good way.
Yeah, a weird good way, but yeah,
it's more rewarding lately for those that have been putting in the time, and those that aren't, it's starting to catch up to them.
Okay, that's great.
All right, so what other Kickstarters? Have you guys backed anything or seen anything on Kickstarter you want to mention?
I have. Like I said, this is my... I don't buy anything for myself, period. So, no. Nope.
Yeah, I'm not allowed to buy any more games until 2016, so I haven't even been looking.
I started organizing. I had to clean up my guest room because someone's coming up and staying in my house for a while. And I realized...
Who's that?
Some bum.
Bum, yeah. I couldn't think of a word. I realized I have more games than I have shelf space for. So immediately, Leslie's like, you can't get any more new games until you start getting rid of games. So I'm not allowed to buy games until I start getting rid of games. So yeah, that's me. So look for a BTG auction for me in the future.
All right. So no Kickstarter mentions from you guys, but I'll mention a couple. Currently up on Kickstarter is, speaking of Bottom of the Ninth being released, we've got another baseball game up right now. This is by Daryl Andrews and... oh my gosh. Sorry. J.R. Honeycutt. Sorry. That's,
I don't know who that is.
Who's that?
I have no idea.
No. He only developed one revolving around Unpub. But they have Fantasy Baseball up right now, which is a fantasy-based or fantasy-themed game that is based around fantasy baseball. In other words, you know, drafting your players and having that kind of a fantasy league or season game. And you should check that out right now. It's on Kickstarter. It's got some cool art. We've been talking to them for quite a while. At least we've heard about it for quite a while. And go check that out. If you like baseball, we recommend it. Also, that I would not say there's really anything like hugely evident on Kickstarter right now, because December is a very quiet month. But yeah, something coming up in early January, and this is not involved with us, we'll talk about something that's coming out late January in a second, but early January is Tiny Epic Western from Gameland Games. Again, this is Scott Alms' design. This is something that I actually played recently with Dan. If you want to hear more about Tiny Epic Western and our gameplay of that, check out the latest Geek All-Stars. And I really enjoyed this. I've played all the Tiny Epic Western, or not Tiny Epic Western, but Tiny Epic games that came up before this. Tiny Epic Kingdoms, Tiny Epic Defenders, and Tiny Epic Galaxies. I liked Tiny Epic Kingdoms a lot. I really enjoyed that. I've been pretty vocal about not really caring for Defenders, but I'm not much of a co-op gamer. Galaxies was pretty good. But Western is really the best offering that I've seen from them through the entire line. I enjoy both the theme, but also the gameplay itself. Again, that'll hit early in January. If you want to hear more about the gameplay, especially probably about 30 minutes worth of talk between me and Dan Patrice on Geek All-Stars, go check that out and keep your eye out for that one.
Did you guys gush about how good that one looks?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, yeah, it looks great, except for, did you do the graphic design of that one?
No, that's all Adam. Adam MacGyver did the art and the graphic design.
Well, the art, absolutely amazing. We have some questions about a couple of the graphic design things, but we all set that in. I think Adam's already been working on that from other feedback. But anything that Adam does, absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And yeah, just the theme, the immersion of the art, the gameplay itself, it really plays itself through as far as the Western theme. So we're super looking forward to that one coming out. I especially am, because I love Western themes in general, but especially ones that are going to embrace, like, you know, shootouts and duels and poker and all these different aspects of the Western theme. They also have, I think, a stretch goal set up for bullet dice, which is crazy. Hopefully they're able to pull it off, because they look super cool. So anyway, we'll have more about that on the podcast. You'll also be able to hear more about that on several other podcasts, because Gameland Games has tons of review copies out there for right now, but that's Tiny Epic Western.
Yes.
So, speaking of Kickstarter, we have Bottom of the Ninth.
That, yeah, we do.
That has just been delivered to Kickstarter backers. We'd like to thank all of you for backing the project. We have gotten some amazing response about Bottom of the Ninth so far. Everybody's been posting session reports, some questions they have about rules, but just overall, the reviews for Bottom of the Ninth, the people who've been playing it, have been spectacular. We're working on, of course, some errata for the solo game, which has a couple questions to it as well. But if you like baseball, or if you don't even like baseball, if you just want to play a two-player game that plays in 15 minutes, that's amazing, check out Bottom of the Ninth.
It plays like nothing you've ever played before.
Well, probably that's probably true.
I'm saying I don't speak lies, Chris. You will learn this.
So TC's not able to hawk this as well as I would expected, but because he's not on the podcast. But
I have his pitch.
There, we'll go right ahead.
This is a live feed of TC's pitch.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
So, do what he says, people. Do it.
Do the opposite of what he says, actually. So, late in January, we have the TC Petty the Third experience coming. And actually, next podcast, I'm sure, because I'll actually chain TC to the computer to talk about it. But it is Don't Get Eated in Club Zen. He had some great demos of that at BGGCon. We've been developing these games for quite a while. Club Zen has been in development for over 2 years. Don't Get Eated for actually 2 years as well, because it was Unpub 3.
Arguably, I told you you should sign Club Zen, too.
Well, you did. It was just at the time we couldn't really afford it, but... You know, moving into it, now we have an actual window we could do it. So both of them are amazing TC Petty the Third games. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have the TC Petty the Third experience on Kickstarter in late January. We'll have the actual dates and more details about that in the next podcast. But Don't Get Eated in Club Zen. Stay tuned. Find out more about them. We're going to have a lot of... promo art hitting BGG soon. Of course, I'll be posting things on DiceHateMe.com by my Twitter feed, so look for that soon.
I want to play Club Zen so bad.
It's amazing. It's so good. I'm not saying that because if I didn't like it, I'd say I didn't like it. But it's amazing. I really, really, really like it.
I was in one of the very first playtests of that game, and even the in-game scoring section wasn't really finished yet. But at that time, if we didn't have other things going on with Dice Hate Me games, I would have immediately signed it. Don't Get Eated was a little bit more like, I mean, even TC designing the game, he designed it, and like in the playtest, it was like ready to go. But he's done nothing but in the past 2 years to refine that, and it's gotten even better. So both games are just humming. I mean, they're super fun. They're obvious TC games. They've got a little bit of quirkiness to them, but a lot of great positive player interaction. And, again... Well,
one of them, not so much.
Well, Don't Get Eated does. It does, no. Because the positive player interaction means that you have to positively interact with other players to make sure your goal is taken. Like, Viva Java... has positive player interaction. It does.
Yeah, but like Don't Get Eated, like I win by screwing everyone over.
No, that's not true, Daryl. Don't undersell the game.
I'm not. No. I'm saying it's a social party game, and so there has to be a little bit of lying into Don't Get Eated. You have to.
There can be, yes. Okay, so Club Zen has a little bit more like pure positive player interaction. In it. Yes.
Yeah.
But you could do the same thing in Club Zen. I mean, there's nothing preventing you from that. But both games, the point of it is that both games embody like the TC vibe of making sure that players have a reason to want to work with other players in the game, even if there is only one winner for the game.
Yes.
And that's the whole point. And that's what's really fun about playing his games is that you do that. Like, you're going to have to work with other players through the game to make sure you're doing the best you possibly can. But in the end, there can only be one winner. They're not truly cooperative. They're semi-cooperative. And they have positive player interaction embroiled in that game. And that's something that's been used a little bit more in the game space since Viva Java came out. But it's still a very TC-oriented type of gameplay. And it's a lot of fun.
Okay, yeah. No, I agree now. Yeah.
There you go.
It's usually in the third act of Don't Get Eated where everyone starts getting vindictive.
Well, they get a little bit... Well, because everybody sees how the scores come out, so you have to kind of, you know, you have to hedge your bets. But, again, it's one of those games with Don't Get Eated that plays in, like, 30 minutes that you're not going to get mad at anybody. It's not going to end friendships.
Yeah, it's not Lifeboat.
No, it's not Lifeboat. No, not at all. So beyond that, I'll be headed to Daryl's soon for a holiday get-together, and we'll be testing out the Dexterity Challenge entries. So look for that coverage on DiceHateMe.com throughout December. And we'll be hopefully announcing the overall winners of that in January, right after the new year. Yes. And also, we'll have details soon about a contest from Christopher Bedell over at Greater Than Games about metagames for our now annual April 1st Meta Kickstarter, which was launched with Unpub, the unpublished card game, and Deck Building, the deck building game on Kickstarter last year. So we'll have more information about that both here on the podcast at DiceHateMe.com and, of course, at GreaterThanGames.com.
Yep.
All right, so Daryl, you got some Unpub news for us?
No, everything's kind of quiet because of the holidays. So it's just gearing down, getting everything set still for Unpub 6. So that's about it. If you have any questions or interest in sponsoring, please email us at sponsors@unpub.net.
Awesome.
And I wanted to mention how much fun I had at the Unpub Mini in the Richmond area last month that Chris came down. Came up from Atlanta to Virginia for the Unpub Mini. It was a great time. I loved it. I had so much fun, and I got to meet Josh Mills. I'd never met him before, and that's where I got to play Matt Wolf's Ubar game, which I'm in love with. So it was such an awesome event.
Yeah, we had a great time. We mentioned some of that on the last podcast, but it's if you have a chance to go to an Unpub Mini in your area, do it, because there's so many fascinating games that are in development from your area. You'll be surprised. But it was good. We went to a Battlegrounds in Midlothian, Virginia, and I played a lot of great games there. We played I played some, of course, by some local designers, you know, Matt Wolf and Josh Mills, and we ended up running out the night with Big City Busking from Josh Mills.
Love that game.
I
loved it.
Oh, it's a lot of fun. It's a really good game. And actually, the game that we played in was four player, which is what Josh really needed to test it. And we kind of ran the game into the ground, which was good, because exactly what he needed. He's made a lot of fixes of that now. So the fourth player game is actually cut almost in half without sacrificing gameplay. Okay. So it's exactly what he needed out of that play test.
Yeah, Josh came up and crashed at my house while he was driving back home from New York. So we spent one night at my place, and he was telling me about that playtest session and pretty much how the Unpub Mini went. So, that was very interesting. And I told him, I was like, dude, those are the best playtests I find, the ones that just crash and burn. So.
It didn't crash and burn.
No. It just lasted a lot longer than should have for that type of game.
Right, but for a designer point of view, when we're seeing our game played and it's not going well, it's crashed and burned.
that is very true. That's probably true. All right. So anybody else? We're all good?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the podcast. I hate we didn't have TC for you guys, but this was actually a really good discussion. And we'll be back soon with more podcast goodness than you can shake a stick at. I haven't used that term in a long time. So we're going to be gearing up for the holidays here. I'll be heading to Daryl's, and we'll be gaming a lot. So I'm sure we'll be talking about some of the games that we play there. Also, along the holidays, we'll try to get Jessica back on to talk about things before we go into Christmas. But for now, that's it for this episode of The State of Games. And if you have any ideas for show topics you'd like for us to cover or new segments you'd like to hear, go to DiceAbe.com and comment on the podcast, or join Guild 1903 on BGG and let us know your thoughts. Now, for those of you who usually stick around to the end to hear the music at the end to see how it relates to the podcast, you'll be rewarded by saying that rumor has it that if you join our guild, that is Guild 1903 on BGG, there may very well be a New Year's contest for guild members. Okay?
What guild is that?
That is Guild 1903.
Where can I type in Guild 1903?
BoardGameGeek.com.
Wow, I should check that out, because I heard there might be a contest.
You've been listening, Daryl. That's shocking. That usually doesn't happen.
So, there's a game with dominoes?
Yeah, oh my God. We won't get into that.
Inside joke, go ahead.
Very big inside joke. Anyway, please join our guild. Comment on the podcast. Come in. Check us out. If you're a member of the guild, around New Year's, we're going to have a really cool giveaway contest for that. So come on by. Also, if you want to join the conversation about anything on this podcast, you can also use hashtag State of Games on Twitter. We're all watching for it. So you can hit me up on Twitter at DiceHateMe. What about the rest of you?
You can find me on Twitter, as usual, at GetLouder, as well as at TheUnpub.
And you can find me, Jessica, on Twitter at JJS1.
All right. Until next time, this is DiceHateMe.
This is Better Than TC, GetLouder.
And this is JJS1.
Saying thanks for listening, and
May all your rolls be sixes.
The contest prize is that you win Chris Mosley's BGG username.
Okay, you probably give that up.